Hello again, everyone, and welcome to episode 76 of Enterprise Linux Security. I'm here, as always, with Zhao, who hails from the world of TuxCare. How you doing?
I'm fine, Jay. As always, it's a pleasure to be here with you. And today we have a news-packed episode.
Yep, I had to ask, like, which one do you want to start with before we hit the record button? Because it's just like so many different things. But of course, we're going to talk about the Aixam news, but that's not even the biggest one we're talking about, but it is the most headline-worthy.
Yeah.
But maybe not. WebP, the libWebP one, which you're going to start with, might even be a little bit more worse in that regard, too. So
there have been quite a few vulnerabilities making the news sites in the past week or so, and the WebP one seems to be the elephant in the room, so we better start with that one. We'll get to the Aixam one. We'll even mention a couple of others that are just as important but haven't had the spotlight shine on them. So, yeah, let's start with the WebP one. Basically, if you're watching any image on the internet right now, you might be at risk of being exploited remotely without even knowing about it, just by looking at an image. That sounds really bad, so let's narrow it down a bit further. It has to be a WebP image, and it has to be specifically crafted so that it triggers a specific code pass in libWebP, which is the library that handles decoding WebP images. But it has been found to be exploitable and to be able to insert malicious code. I should phrase that differently. It can allow attackers to change the execution path of the program that you're using in a way that favors them. So there is quite some history behind this one. Early in September, so about less than a month ago, actually, it was disclosed on September 7th, the initial thing. And this security group, Citizens Lab, I believe, was looking at the phone from a civilian employee of a civilian group in Washington, D.C., and they found out that it had the Pegasus spyware deployed. And upon further analysis, they identified the no-day flaw, a zero-day flaw that allowed Pegasus to be deployed on that phone. They contacted Apple security group, which looked at the problem, which identified the problem at the time as present in Chrome, and they communicated to Google, which then proceeded to analyze the problem, prepare a fix, and that's why you've been seeing so many updates for Chrome in the past few weeks. Not just Chrome, we'll go over all the other applications, but Chrome was the initial, was thought to be the initial vector for this. The initial vulnerability got the CVE assigned. We'll have all the numbers of the CVEs. I just don't want to keep pushing out numbers for CVEs out here. If you look for WebP vulnerability, you'll find that it's referenced everywhere. The initial entry, the initial CVE got assigned, got a 9.8 score, so pretty bad. When Google tracked down the actual problem as being a part of libWebP, not specifically Chrome or Chromium, the rendering engine, they got assigned a different vulnerability, which got a perfect 10 out of 10 score, so end of the world scenario right there. Eventually, Google asked for it to be marked as a duplicate of the first one, so they got merged together. To give you some context, the CVE entry for this, even though it has only been published 7 days ago, so the story evolved a bit from the early September 7th incident, even though it was announced on the 27th of last month, it has already had 27 revisions to the CVE entry. If you've ever looked at CVE entries before, you don't see that even in years-old vulnerabilities. So this has been having a lot of attention from everyone.
Wow.
So what exactly is WebP and how does this come to happen? How is it possible to have something like this come out? So WebP is a good image format because it lets you get really small images without losing content. You can get lossless images much smaller than you would usually have otherwise, or compressed images at less size than even JPEG at comparable quantization values. Now, if you know something about compression, you know that one of the things that you need to take care of when you're compressing anything, whether it's images or text or whatever, is that you need to take special care with the way that the information is actually encoded on the file. So one thing that's very common to happen is that you look at the frequency of characters or what objects or whatever you're encoding on the given data that you want to compress, and then encode it in such a way that the stuff that happens more frequently takes up less bits than the stuff that happens only once or twice. So let's say, imagine that you're compressing text. You can choose to assign 3 bits to represent a very common letter like A or E, and then you can use like 6 or 7 bits to encode a Z or a Q. So those will happen very less often in the actual data that you're compressing. So they can be assigned more bits, as that won't affect the output as much. When you're trying to to uncompress the content, you have to do the opposite. So you have to look at the information that you have, and you have to have some guidance. In this case, a table that tells you, okay, this particular sequence corresponds to this character. That sequence corresponds to a different character. The encoding that they use for WebP uses something called Huffman encoding. You'll see this on several other compression mechanisms because it's quite common on the compression world. And the library responsible for doing the uncompress is libwebp, as I've mentioned. This is available on basically any operating system. It's very common, and it's that type of thing that you don't want to reinvent each time that you're writing code. So you use something that's already out there, that has already been tested, and is widely used. Basically, any application that shows you webp files or lets you process webp files is at some point calling into that library, and as a consequence is vulnerable to this. The actual flaw happens when you're trying to show the content, and in the way that you read that table, that frequency table, back into memory. It's possible to craft the file in such a way that when it's trying to recreate that table, it will allocate a specific amount of memory, but will then try to write more memory, that more content than fits into that allocation. And then you get the buffer overflow. And it's possible to control what gets written outside of that buffer. So you know what you will be overwriting in memory, and you can control what gets written in those, on those places of memory. And that's why it's so bad. And
yeah, remote code execution. Oh, boy.
And this happens even without your interaction. Say you have Signal or Telegram or any other chat application, and somebody sends you an image with this type of content. As soon as that image gets rendered, you're already compromised. So it has already happened. You don't need to click anything. You don't need to follow links. Nobody has to trick you into clicking something or into agreeing to anything. It just happens as soon as you receive it. And that's why it's really nasty.
So presumably that could also happen if there's malvertising, I would think, too. If there's an image being rendered by Chrome and it's in an ad or somewhere on the page, it would be the same problem.
Or if somebody sends you an email, even if you don't click the email and this is present inside the signature image or something like that, then as soon as the image gets rendered, this has already happened.
Wow.
So this is
what's big.
This falls into a category of exploits, sorry for cutting you off, that is called zero-click exploits, meaning that the user doesn't have to interact with anything in order to trigger this behavior. To give you some context, last week there was this advertisement going around where somebody was asking if you have any new zero-day exploits that target iOS devices, we'll give you $20 million, no questions asked. You'll get access to a remote iOS device. If you can demonstrate the exploit, we'll give you the money, you show us how it's done, and we'll part ways. That's the easiest $20 million you can do if you happen to know something like this. That's how important these type of vulnerabilities are. So much so that the NSO group, the Israeli company responsible for the Pegasus spyware, is using it to deploy their spyware on phones of and suspecting victims. And this is one of the ways that they can do this. This is how they can target phones of journalists, of government officials and all of that, without even having to trick them into doing anything and without requiring physical access to their devices. This is really, really nasty.
Yeah, and I was also thinking, too, like, you know, obviously patch, that's what we always say. But then I think about all the Android phones specifically that aren't being updated anymore. And there's going to be a ginormous number of those still being used today because, you know, not everybody can deal with planned obsolescence, so they don't always get a phone every year. So they have a phone from the past, and I know depending on who made the handset, some companies do an amazing job of keeping them updated and others don't. But if you're one of those unlucky ones that have an Android phone that they're not prioritizing updates on, then hopefully that still gets a... I know Google also gives out security patches separate from the Android OS now, but make sure that it's being patched. But I'm worried about those that aren't going to get a patch because then they're going to be vulnerable.
Apparently, the fix has already been added to the Android codebase, but I don't know if vendors have already released fixes for all of the models out there. Of course, not all of the models will ever get patches like you mentioned. But right now, basically any Android phone is vulnerable to this. Apple has already released some fixes. But the thing is, this goes much further than just the mobile devices. All the web browsers are affected by this. Firefox, Chrome, Brave, the Tor browser, which is based on Firefox, I believe, all their derivatives out there, basically anything that touches on WebP's, anything that can show WebP's, and not just internet-able applications, anything. If you have a malicious file on disk and you open it on an editor that depends on libWebP, it can trigger an expected behavior through this.
Right.
This is one of the most massive vulnerabilities out there in, I don't know, since Log4j, basically.
Yep. Yeah, this is just one of those... It kind of reminds me, in a different time period where you were hearing about specially crafted PDF documents and Word documents, and then before that, macros were huge. And I'm not saying any of those things aren't problems now, because obviously, it's not like that attack vector went away. But this kind of makes me think of back then when we were having to be really careful about opening PDF documents for a number of years straight, because that was super popular. Now it's images.
And this one has already seen exploits in the wild, so like that phone that was found, but not just that phone, there are other exploits in the wild. There is proof of concept code available on the internet. There are very in-depth and very technical analysis to this and why it happens. And there are even some comments on the fix that Google put out. The fix itself apparently does not fix the actual underlying issue. It just makes sure to avoid the values that they know won't fit on that area. If you're a developer, when you don't address the actual issue, the actual problem, and you just put some makeup over the symptoms, you might be facing the same problem further along the line. So what might happen is that they might be addressing some situations that they have found cause this behavior, but because it's so tricky to replicate and to go down the line and try to identify every single situation, there might be others that have been missed. In fact, precisely because the original situation that caused this is so difficult to trigger by accident, one of the things that is used on this particular code is called a fuzzer. A fuzzer is a tool that you use on development that tries random stuff. It throws random inputs and random settings at your application and tries to get it to fail, so that you identify the situations that cause problems in your application while you're doing development and not in production. This particular code has been fuzzed before, and it didn't trigger this. This was not found. And even with the fix, there have been some people claiming that there are other situations where this can happen. Again, you might see some more updates coming from this, but if you see updates for any application that you use that you suspect that might see images, your email client, Thunderbird were something that was affected that has already seen updates. There are lots of applications that haven't had updates yet, but others already did and might see also other updates coming in the next few days.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. So basically, threat actors are really good at, working around workaround. So they put a workaround in a patch, and they work around the workaround, and you have to patch that until, they run out of things and they try something else. But to your point, definitely update.
It's the incentives,
Yep.
If you're receiving $20 million for finding something like this, you're very highly incentivized to look really hard for problems.
Oh, yeah.
If you're part of a bug bounty program on some company that promises to give you like $10,000 for finding problems, and then they take like 6 months to validate your submission, and then they will dispute that submission, they eventually end up agreeing to only paying you $100, then you might not be very incentivized to reporting this to the software company. You might just go to the other side of the fence and get much more money for it. And that has been a problem for years now in cybersecurity, and it continues to be. That ad that I mentioned before, the $20 million one of the comments from the original poster on that is that it will definitely be used in the current conflict by one of the players in the current conflict in Ukraine. So one of the sides is behind that request, and they already have victims for that particular exploit. That's why they are being so particular about targeting iOS devices. They know who they want to hit with it. So, yeah, it goes way beyond just traditional cybersecurity. Basically, anything the NSO group has released in the past has already been targeting governments and all of that. So this is pretty high level. The fact that basically any application is vulnerable to it is just an unexpected side effect that's pretty good for them.
Understood, yeah.
But yeah, the bottom line here, your takeaway from this one is that you should definitely look at your update list. You should definitely run through the updates that you have available and deploy every single one of them. So now that we have the WebP vulnerability out of the way, let me just do a quick detour on one that I hadn't pinged you before about. It's on binutils. If you're running a Linux system and you're unsure if you have binutils deployed or not, you do. Okay, so don't think too much about it. It's on your system. You need to update it. You need to update it because two vulnerabilities have been disclosed just 3 or 4 days ago. One is another 9.8. The other is an 8.8. They deal with the way that they have a term for this that eludes me here, but these tools are basically debuggers and compilers and tools to assist in creating and compiling programs. But when compiling a program, you can pass it some flags that change the behavior of the compiler itself. And in the way that those flags are being handled, there is a problem. It usually takes a value in the form of like an environment variable. This variable equals a value, and then two dots, and then another variable equals another value. And it has been found that if you put variable equals another variable equals a value, so no two dots in between, you can cause all kinds of havoc with the code down the line, so it will introduce issues. And again, it's found on basically any Linux distribution. It's found on other devices, IoT, all the works. And you really need to address that one because it gives code execution and the privilege elevation, which you don't want users to get.
Yeah, definitely.
Now let's move to the one that got us this nice topic for today. You got malware. This one is you got email, and it's probably malicious. So, email. Talking about email.
Where do we begin with email?
Yeah, email is already such a can of worms that it's tricky to go through it. And it wasn't like this before, but it has only been worse. It has only been getting worse. On the email sending world, you only have three big players. You have Postfix, you have Exim, you have Sendmail. Sendmail is the older one of all of these guys, and it's pretty outdated by this point. So if you have an email software that's sending email to other systems, you're probably running either Postfix or Exim, very likely Exim. And I hear somebody in the back, oh, but I'm using Exchange, I'm using Exchange. Oh, poor you, Microsoft sysadmin, I've been there, I know your pain. Getting back to Exim, six vulnerabilities were disclosed last week. They range from 9.8 all the way down to 3.something, but there are four that allow for remote code execution. There are quite some specific conditions that you need to meet for each one. Let me just get my notes to make sure that I'm not missing any of them. If you have them at hand, feel free to jump in.
Yeah, I'm looking now. So, yep, I see it. So with the first one, external authentication scheme configured and available, that's one requirement. Another is SPA module for NTLM authentication configured and available. Third, An XM proxy, you know, just according to this, is different from a SOX or HTTP proxy in use with an untrusted proxy server. Another one is an SPF condition used in an ACL. SPA module configured to authenticate the XM server, and I'm reading from the article that's linked in the description. And then the final one is an untrusted DNS resolver. So my understanding is if any one of those are true, you're vulnerable.
Yeah. So this was announced to the big scare of everybody because XM is included in some web hosters control panel. It's the default thing that gets bundled in with them. I won't name them because I don't want to shine a bad light on them, but it's just a good email server that has some issues. It happens. Looking at the external one, one thing that you'll go through in your sysadmin career or when you're looking at ID in general and you're starting and trying to understand protocols and all of that is telnetting directly to the ports of some services. Telnetting to port 25 lets you basically talk to the email server and insert email commands and get responses back all in plain text. One of the things that you can pass the email server is the authentication method that you want to use. One such authentication method that requires the server to be allowed to use it is called external. It means that you'll be sending a certificate to the server. The server will validate that certificate and then trust you to be you, okay? Or fail that validation and won't trust you. So that's what the external authentication is. If you're configured to use to accept external authentication, means that you won't just use username and password, you'll trust certificates. It has been found to be possible to craft that certificate in a special way that gets you to, again, another buffer overflow and lets you compromise some memory inside of XM and leads to all kinds of nasty things. It's not very easy to exploit because unlike the previous vulnerability that we saw on WebP, the actual data that you can overwrite here is much more limited. There's a specific amount of data that's usable and writable and you can compromise that hasn't been yet been shown to be easily exploited. Still, if it happens to be exploitable, it will be with high privileges and you can do it remotely, so not even touching the system. Nobody is the wisest and you manage to compromise the email server.
Lovely.
Yeah, all kinds of good. The next one, the SPA module, it's used for NTLM authentication. On layman terms, for that Microsoft sysadmin in the back, that's all smug for running Exchange. This means that you're authenticating against, say, an Active Directory, for example. Your XM is running authentication checks against Active Directory and using the result. You only need to have the NTLM configured for this to be exploitable. Not all organizations will have it. Not all organizations are running hybrid environments with Windows, but some will. So if you happen to be, then you either upgrade XM or the recommendation from the vendor, and this is pretty funny because it's an email server, is to restrict access to the internet, to the XM server. Again, I don't quite understand how the emails are supposed to reach the server at that point, but that's the guidance that they're offering at this point.
Yeah, you could turn the server off to just unplug it, and that'll also work.
Yeah. So, again, that's a recommendation. That's the official thing that you should do if you're not able to update XM right now.
I just love that. It's like, mitigation, stop using the software.
You know, I did...
Like, yeah, okay.
I didn't mention this before on the WebP story, but Google's recommendation, if you can't patch Chrome at the point, is to stop using Chrome until you that time as you can update it. It's that bad. And so I don't see it as different on this case. It's just all kinds of nasty again. I'm not specially familiar with XM proxy. I imagine this is a situation where you use a third server in the middle between you and your intended target. I have no particular knowledge about this module. The SPF condition in the ACL, it just means that it's possible to trick what your email server is trusting as being a reliable server on the other end of the communication or not. The SPA module, again, used for NTLM authentication, falls into the same category as the one as having Active Directory in place, it's actually two different vulnerabilities that exploit this. So be especially careful if you have Active Directory and you're using Exim to authenticate against it. The untrusted DNS resolver, that's always a problem. If the information that you get from the DNS server is untrusted, if you're trusting on third parties to give you good name resolution, they can just trick you, basically. I know everybody blindly trusts Google's name servers and OpenDNS name servers, and those are actually pretty decent. But you're blindly trusting those servers. If they happen to mess up or if they happen to have the wrong information in them, that's what they'll give you, and that's where you'll send your emails. So, again, that's not specially new. It just means that DNS resolution is DNS resolution and will continue to be.
Yeah, DNS will be DNS. It'll always be the causer of issues.
If not directly, then just
indirectly. Indirectly. Yeah. And if it's not DNS, it's printers. There's always just one or the other in IT. You know, we hate them both. It's always one or the other.
The thing with these Exim vulnerabilities is that the way that this is exploited is actually pretty old school. Talking directly to the SMTP server is something that you used to do in the late 90s, early 2000s, just to see if you could send email directly. Again, friend exercise. You telnet to a port 25 SMTP server. You say hello with just one L. It comes back with hello, and then you send, you type, let me see if I can quote this from memory, to, and then an email server, an email address, and then enter, and then type your message, end with a dot on a single line, enter again, and the email gets sent as if you had used directly a client. That's a fun mm-hmm. exercise if you're looking into understanding how these things work. But this is something yep. that was done like 20 years ago, and is part of the way that you can trick email servers still to this day, which is fun.
Yeah, some things never change. And I think there's going to be some people out there that might be thinking, big deal, I don't even have an email server, so why do I care? If you don't have an email server, you especially need to check. I know that seems like the opposite of the advice normally, but and you know where I'm going with this. If you're sure you're not running an email server, and that's fine, just make sure you don't have this installed and running, because just because that's not the function of your server doesn't mean it's lurking and accepting things in the background. So just make sure that you don't have a mail agent or any other piece of software that's running and listening that you have no intention of using at all. Just get rid of it. I don't mean to stop the service. And I don't mean disable it, remove it. Because even if you disable it with systemctl, then you could still have a situation where you have like a side channel that re-enables it, and they just go in and use it against you anyway. So if you have zero intention of using it and it has zero purpose on your server, as with anything else, just lower the threat surface by removing what you're not using. And if you do use this, then you're going to have to look at these vulnerabilities and see what the mitigations are, which I assume is patching, right? That's the idea, or has it been patched yet?
Yeah, that's the thing. You have patches available for all of this, so you really need to take a look at the patches that you have available for your system and do mm-hmm. not delay them. I know we always say this, but this time it's particularly bad. These ones are remotely exploitable. That's one level higher bad. So you don't even need local access. You don't need an account. You don't need to break in some other way. Just by being reachable on the internet, you can be affected by this. And what you were mentioning before about reducing the attack surface reminds me of one of my old pet peeves when I started deploying systems on actual servers.
And I know where you're going with this.
And one of the things that always annoyed me was when the default installation would install stuff like Bluetooth on servers, which you never need Bluetooth on servers, and the services were always running. And it was not just one service, but like four or five different services, because Bluetooth needs to be listening for file transfers and for authentication and for target talking to other Bluetooth devices. And you would get this immense list of services that are just popping out from a default installation that you then have to go through and remove every single one. This is before you say, oh, but why don't you use automation and deploy just what you need? This is way before automation was a thing. This is when you actually deployed systems to bare metal, actual metal, the stuff that you needed two people to raise to the rack and put in place. And it was one of my pet annoyances, always having to go through every single default installation, killing all of that stuff. Really, really annoying. And today, it's also funny that some server distributions still leaves things in, like, say, X server and stuff that you'll never need on a server, and it still gets deployed, it still gets bundled in, and sometimes it's even activated when you don't need it. So, yeah.
I've had that happen a lot of times when there's a hostable software that you install headless. You know, if you're new to this, that means no monitor. But then it'll install the libraries for the X windowing manager and all these other things just because you might need it, or it might need image magic or these other things to, you know, generate pictures and whatnot. And a lot of things come along for the ride. I would say what is a challenge for everyone listening, depending on how old your distro is, it's netstat or the SS command is a newer way to do it. Just run that and look for the ports that are listening. Just look. Just have a quick look at this. And if it's a web server, then obviously you're expecting your web server service to be listening. Obviously, that's what it's for. But if you're not hosting email on there, then if there's something listening for email connections, that's a potential red flag, or anything else that's running. If there's an NFS server running and you have no intention of mounting or sharing NFS with it, I mean, then why is it there? Get rid of it. And you go through these things, I feel like it's, to your point, I don't think it's something anyone should have to do. I think the default should be more sensible. And that's been a pet peeve of mine as well, that, you know, you get all these things that you might need. And I thought I was just one of the few people that just wants the distribution and the apt package manager and nothing else, like absolutely nothing else. Like, it should just, in my mind, be enough to boot and apt install something, and then anything else, no, I don't want anything else. But even the net install of Debian will have a few things in there that you'll need to remove, and that's often considered one of the lighter ones.
You're an arch user in disguise.
No, almost, but not quite.
Someone was mentioning on the chat, yes, another vector for XM being present is Docker images. Lots of Docker images out there right now haven't been updated yet and still include XM, older XM. So that's something that you also need to update. So look for updated images if you're using Docker, because stuff like the control panel hosting, that stuff includes email by default, and the email that they usually bring in is XM. Again, XM is being a victim of its own success, basically. The numbers that came out when this vulnerability was announced was that this was present on like 600,000 systems out there. That's a lot. That's a lot of systems being vulnerable. And if there's anything that we've been taught in the past couple of years, is that everybody goes out and updates as soon as the vulnerability comes out, right? Yeah.
I wish. And I'm just remembering early in my Linux career, like, I think it was over 20 years ago, I remember, I can't even remember which distro it was. And then I remember looking for the very first time. And I think this is probably true of any Linux admin when they look at this for the first time and they look at the open ports on their server and their server has one purpose, but they find like 10 different things on there. My reaction was, what is this doing here? Why is that on? Why is that listening? And I think probably any Linux admin will have that experience, depending on the distro, of course, when they look at that for the first time and see what all's listening. And then, you know, obviously, if you need XM, then patch it. If you don't, then remove it.
Yeah, like you just said, it's one of those surprises that we will get you when you're starting out as a sysadmin. It's like just updating the packages is not enough to make you secure. You actually have to restart the services to pick up the changes. That's something that also got me when I was starting, and to this day, I know it surprises some people. Just because you used your YAM or your apt or Pacman or whatever to get updates, and you're feeling very smug that you just patched against, say, OpenSSL or something like that, until you restart every single application that was using it, those applications are still vulnerable, are still using the older version. The same thing goes for XM. If your update manager does not restart services automatically, and most don't, when you get the new XM, you have to restart the service to pick up the changes. So,
That's very important. Yep, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah.
we tried not to do a very scary episode. The WebP vulnerability is actually pretty nasty. The XM one, because it has all of those requirements for you to actually be exploitable, for your systems to be exploitable, it might not be that much of a problem if you don't fall into those categories. But definitely look at it. As Jay mentioned it, you might have XM running even if you don't necessarily have it deployed explicitly. It might be part of something else, or it might just be a default. Take a look at your systems. This is dangerous stuff. This is more dangerous, especially the WebP one, because it affects everything. It doesn't really matter if it's Linux. It affects any operating system, any device. If you have updates to do, you really should go out and look at them and get those updates as soon as possible. This is really tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was it for our episode today. Thank you very much to everybody who joined. There are some very interesting aspects to these vulnerabilities. Jay will add the links to the video, I'm sure, for you to get more information about it, including the actual CVE numbers. And we'll see you on the next one. It was a pleasure.
See you around.
Bye.
Thanks.